We all know that the earth has had its share of troubling times. A brief review of history reminds us of perpetual world problems. I mean, they have been all around, and even Scripture does not hesitate to communicate the problems that have been throughout history. And if you've studied church history, world history, any history, you know, it's been all over the place. Every part of the world, all of the issues that are there. And then a review of Scripture reminds us why it's so. Genesis chapter 3, mankind falling into sin. That is why we have all of these things. Now, if you do not have that perspective, if you do not see that connection, then you are going to come to some radically faulty conclusions when you see things going on in this world. And you may think that the human race is really good, and that if we just try harder and are educated adequately, that we will be able to conquer all problems. We know that's not exactly how that works. We need to look somewhere else. And so we have the Lord and His Word. But knowing the what, those things that have happened, are happening, will happen, and the why does not alleviate the pain of going through those times. That's the reality that we're dealing with right now when we see things going on around us. How do we cope with those things? And historically, we think about many people have suffered terribly due to the effects of sin in this world. And we daily deal with the effects of sin to some degree, whether it be of our own making or whether it be our connection with someone around us, all of us dealing with the effects of sin personally and corporately in a broken world. But how do we deal with the direct and immediate oppression of a godless government? That seems to be something that's weighing heavily on our hearts and minds these days as well. How do we deal with that? Most of us in our time and nation have had little issue with that, but we are seeing it come to fore more and more. And we know many people throughout the world who have had to deal with it in ways that are staggering. But we know that things are moving in that direction in our nation as well. And so as we think about that backdrop and the text that we're looking at today, I want us to try to think about what is it that we can learn from the experience of others who have gone through similar kinds of things in maybe a different context, but with some comparable matters. What can we learn from that? So I want to begin looking at the text and thinking about the making of a governmental ultimatum. Verses 1 and 2 of Daniel chapter 3, we read, Nebuchadnezzar the king made an image of gold whose height was 60 cubits and its width 6 cubits. He set it up in the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. And King Nebuchadnezzar sent word to gather together the satraps, the administrators, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image which King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. So the satraps, the administrators, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces gathered together for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up, and they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. That's a picture that we can somewhat imagine, and so we want to give some consideration to that. The concern for unity seems rational and reasonable. When you gather a bunch of people together, you usually do so in order to encourage, promote or cause unity. You usually don't want to do that unless it's to create a war, but then you need to have unity to go against war. So there's that context for that, but that's slightly different than what we're talking about here. There was an image of gold, and that sounds familiar, doesn't it? This particular image was very tall and very weighty and impressive. It was 60 cubits high, in the ballpark of 90 feet, by about 9 feet wide. The famous Colossus of Rhodes was one of the seven wonders of the world. Back in an earlier day, it stood about 70 cubits high. It was at the entrance of the port of that ancient city. It was put up about 280 BC, so that would have been after this time historically, and it only lasted a few years before an earthquake destroyed a good chunk of it. But it would have required something of that weight and height would have required a substantial base. Just like when you build skyscrapers, you've got to go way down and get a really solid foundation before you can go up. It would have required something of that nature as well. And it would likely have been a representation of the king himself. It doesn't tell us exactly, but based on other things that we have seen from that era, that would likely have been the case. And it may have said something about him, like maybe the size of his ego. Trying to communicate something. And archaeologists have discovered various Babylonian images of various types, and these images were often quite narrow in proportion to their height. So that sort of design seems to be not uncommon in that area. They were normally made of wood that were overlaid with gold, and many things in the Old Testament were referred to in that sense, though there were times when things were made out of pure gold as well. Herodotus described the statue of Bel, that was one of the gods, that was made of 800 talents of gold. That would be 22 tons. But Nebuchadnezzar's image would have been much heavier and more costly than that, just to give some perspective. The image was put on display rather intentionally. It was intended to be seen. It was on the plain of Dura. It's assumed, understood, probably that this would have been about 6 miles southeast of Babylon itself. The Aramaic word Dura means fortification. And it was a common designation. It could refer to an enclosure by wall or by mountains or other things of that nature. But we also are reminded in the previous chapter of this book of Daniel that the king had had a dream of an image of gold at the top that represented him. And so it seems that he may have gotten an idea from that dream. Oh, an image of gold. That's pretty cool. And since I'm such a cool guy, I'm at the top, let's just make the whole thing out of gold, and this will be a monument to myself. And so I think that likely was the case. So he commissioned this huge image of gold, and we can wonder at his purpose. We can speculate. It was likely to impress, to draw people's attention, to give something to focus around. We might wonder whether it was a rebellious reaction to the authority of Yahweh that he had been reminded of in the previous chapter. Was it perhaps an attempt towards some element of self-deification, some sort of a focus of worship, which obviously that's going to be part of the equation? Was it some sort of a unifying effort to bring the diversity of the people that he had under his authority together to focus on him as the pinnacle of things? Or was it some combination of all of that? Could have been. Then think about the list of authorities that are represented here. It was rather extensive, and the thought that came to my mind as I was looking at this and trying to analyze it, I thought, huh, I guess big government was not a new thing. He had a lot of people that made up his government as well. And we see things moving in that direction. And as 1 Samuel chapter 8 reminds us, when you head in that direction, that tends to be how it works. When there's one person at the top, they gather people to do their work for them, whether they like it or not. And there are several positions that are mentioned here, different groups. Some of the titles of the officials that are named in the text are Persian and some are Babylonian, and Daniel may have updated some of these in his when he was putting the final form to his writing, or they may have already been titles that were used as early as that, because Persia didn't become prominent until a little bit later. So there's a reference to the satraps. They were the highest political officials in each of the provinces. The administrators, princes in some versions, were military chiefs. The governors were heads of sections of provinces. We can relate to that. We have governors in our nation. The counselors or advisors were high-ranking judges. The treasurers, of course we can understand that, they were superintendents of the treasury. The judges, also forms of counselors, were secondary judges. The magistrates, referenced in some versions, were lower-level legal officials. The final reference to officials were subordinates of the satraps. So all of these people are part of the administrative governing bodies that were involved, and they, because of the nature of the empire, were diverse enough to bring them in, and they encompass some different languages as well. So all of that is part of the picture that is involved here. And there may be a question as to whether there was more than one occasion of the meeting together around this image. Was there an initial time where the leaders were involved and another time where the people themselves who were available to come might have been involved, so that when Daniel's three friends didn't cooperate the first time, they may have had opportunity to cooperate the second time. That's somewhat speculation, but it's a possibility. And so also we see rallying people around a common purpose has some value. And so you can see if Nebuchadnezzar's purpose, because he was new, fairly new to reigning, his father had died, and so he was brought in. Maybe he was wanting to sort of establish himself and make an impression on the people and bring them together around himself. That could have been considered a wise administrative thing to do, to get some unity, to get everybody together, to make sure we're all on the same page, to maybe test their loyalty. Are you really loyal to me or are you not? Who is with me? Who is against me? It would certainly have indicated where people stand. And when pronouncements are made, it does tend to cause people to have to indicate where they stand. Of course, we're facing many defining laws and demands that will indicate where we stand. We have to deal with that same thing, and we see that intensifying. Then looking at verses 3, Daniel chapter 3, verses 4 and 5. Then a herald cried aloud, "To you it is commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages, that at the time you hear the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, and psaltery, in symphony with all kinds of music, you shall fall down and worship the gold image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up." At least he conscripted somebody else to tell them that they needed to worship him and his image, essentially. Then verses 6 and 7. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast immediately into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. So at that time, when all the people heard the sound of the horn, flute, harp, and lyre in symphony with all kinds of music, all the people, nations, and languages fell down and worshipped the gold image which King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. So that picture is fairly clear in terms of what is involved there. What we see is the demand for absolute conformity seems oppressive. It's a bit much in some contexts. What are you asking? Well, this particular production included extravagant musical production. There was a lot of people involved in the playing of this, so it was kind of a big deal. Verse 4 indicates the diversity of the people involved, different peoples, languages, etc. The peoples of this land were diverse already. The area that we're talking about here, there was some diversity among them. And then when you think about the people that would have been brought in from other nations, like what Assyria had done, what Babylon had done in capturing other peoples and bringing some of them in, you can see that you would have had some diversity. You would have had some reason to want to bring about a sense of unity and then to prove your commitment, your submission to the king. So this special presentation would likely have had an emphasis on bringing people together, but also probably testing the loyalty, because that's exactly what was going on. And then the variety of instruments suggests it was a major kind of production, just because of the people that would have to have been involved in the number of different instruments and the emphasis on all kinds of music. There would have been wind and stringed instruments involved. So it was a big deal. Very intentional, very purposeful. It would have been a celebratory kind of event. And so you wonder, though, what were the people thinking who were there when they saw this going on? Did they say, this is a great idea, let's all worship this image that is focused on King Nebuchadnezzar, because that is just such a good thing to do? Or did they say, really? Okay, whatever you say, we'll just pretend to do it. Because when you say, you've got to worship, how can you see what's going on inside? Worship is something that goes on inside. All they can see is you bow down, but you can't force the worship. And so were the people saying, well, okay, I'll bow down to you, but it's not going to mean anything to me. You can just think what you want. So it includes a demand for submission and worship. The diverse groups were all commanded to uniformly, everybody participate, fall down. And it's pretty obvious if you're in this crowd and you're still standing. I mean, you'd think that would show up. You'd be able to see that. And worship the image when the music played. And it appeared that the people generally conformed to this. But again, we wonder, did they do it? Were they actually worshiping? And how do you go about doing that in that context? I'm just trying to imagine what that would have been like. But it also included severe consequences for failure to comply. Failure to conform would involve immediate action, according to the threat that is made here. There is no trial. There is no recourse. There's no appeals. You die. That's it. It's do or die, literally. And so the result would be immediate incineration, a fiery furnace. Now, what exactly was this fiery furnace? It may have been one that was used to like a kiln for making the bricks that were used for the various building projects. Those were around. Or it may have been a sort of a funnel-shaped a furnace, like an upside-down funnel for melting or a smelting ore with a couple of openings at the bottom, one for maybe utilizing bellows, another for putting in fuel, and so on, and just to be able to accomplish what you need to do. So there had to be some way of working with that. And I kind of was pondering, why incineration? Why was that? Was the king trying to imitate God as imitating hell? I mean, is that a possibility? Did they think about that? I assume that that would have been something that they would have been aware of. Or was it just the most threatening kind of death imaginable, of a horrible nature? Because anything about serious burns sounds really bad. So, pressing on, the necessity of a response under pressure. Verses 8 through 10, we read this, beginning at verse 8. Therefore, at that time, certain Chaldeans came forward and accused the Jews. They spoke and said to King Nebuchadnezzar, O king, live forever. Again, we would never say that to any of our leaders. Verse 10, you, O king, have made a decree that everyone who hears the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, and psaltery in symphony with all kinds of music fall down and worship the gold image. Picking up at verse 11, and whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. There are certain Jews whom you have set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, have not paid due regard to you. A personal affront here. They do not serve your gods or worship the gold image which you have set up. So this seems like a time frame, like they must have had an occasion to respond. Was it more than one occasion that different ones came because you couldn't fit everybody there to see the image? It's not really clear. But there was some time that would have involved where they came back after this was observed. Opportunistic tattletale conformists are not new. They're still around. We have been seeing them. We have heard some of them. Beware. Also, anti-Semitism has been ongoing and is still growing. It's been going on for a long time. There has always been animosity among different people groups, regardless of color, area, ethnicity, whatever. That's just how people are, because we're fallen sinners. And so when we're dealing with the critical race theory and all of that stuff that's going on, the problem is sin. And we need to deal with that in a different way other than just make reparations and all of that. And, of course, the Jews have been the object of oppression probably more than any other group historically. And that's largely due to the satanic influence, because Christ was coming through them and they are in God's plan for the future, and therefore they are an object of oppression. And the Jews have often been treated as expendable. And the question we might have is, was this incidental of them being Jews, or was it because they were Jews? I question whether it was just because they were Jews. It may have been just because they were foreigners. And the word Jew, when it's used in the Old Testament, is usually a pejorative term, which is interesting as well. And that's how it was used on many occasions. But there were certain Chaldeans that pointed out some Jewish nonconformists. The rationale for the complaint is not specifically noted as to why they were wanting to come down on them, but it's expected that it may have been for some personal advantage. And these Chaldeans that are referenced here were probably nobles, not just astrologers, so they would have had a place of position in some form or another, though the Chaldeans were generally associated with not just the name of a group of people, but a profession in terms of astrologers as well. So some have speculated that maybe that these particular Chaldeans wanted the positions that these foreigners had. They may have been envious of that, or they were just hateful of them because they were foreigners, or maybe because they were Jews. Or they were just angry that some people didn't conform. They were rebels. They rebelled. They didn't comply. Or it could have been some combination of all of these things. And as I think about this text, I think, well, you know, there are various contexts where I know I can be a little bit rebellious as well. When certain things come along, there are various trends that come along. And I tend to rebel against most of the trends because it's just a trend. Why do I want to do that? That's dumb. Until a trend's over, and then if there's some value in it, then I might think, okay, I might try it now just because it's not a trend anymore. That's why I'm not trendy. You wondered why. Then there are irrational rules. I won't go into what I think those are, but you may have some ideas of your own. And ungodly laws. There are plenty of those, and they are proliferating. There are so many things in our world, our nation, our lives today that we cannot comply with, even though we are encouraged and at times enforced to do so. So we're dealing with this proliferation of irrational rules, ungodly laws that are coming at us at somewhat of a dizzying pace. And we wonder how long before we are turned in for noncompliance to various things. Are we prepared for this kind of confrontation? How long can we hold on under the pressure that is mounting? Pressure to conform. One commentator writing on this passage said, "In situations like this, no crime is greater than nonconformity, yet that is exactly what God asks of us when the things of the world are arrayed against the things of God." Reminds you of Romans chapter 12, verses 1 and 2. "I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, wholly acceptable unto God, which is your reasonable service, and do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind." Are we prepared to not conform to this world? But that requires discernment. We need to know what really requires nonconformity or resistance, and not just being a rebel like I am sometimes. What is really important that where we need to stand up? Now, the friends of Daniel are referenced here, but Daniel is not. He's not mentioned. And, of course, some have wondered, well, where was Daniel when all of this was going on? Why isn't he mentioned? He was one of the group there. Did he conform and worship the image? Or was there some other reason? Was he above accusation because of his higher position? Was he away on official business? Was he ill? Did he have a virus? I'm just kidding. Or something else? What was the reason? Well, every indication is that Daniel, had he been there, that he would have resisted also. But here the focus is on the three friends. It seems that God does not test all of his children in the same way at the same time. Daniel will be tested later, as we will see, as you already remember and know. So moving on, verses 13 and 14. Then Nebuchadnezzar, in rage and fury, gave the command to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So they brought these men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar spoke, saying to them, "Is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the gold image which I have set up?" He's at least asking them first. Verse 15. "Now, if you are ready at the time you hear the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, and psaltery, and symphony with all kinds of music, and you fall down and worship the image which I have made, good. But if you do not worship, you shall be cast immediately into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you from my hands?" A little bit of arrogance kind of sounding there. What do we observe from this? Defiance of secular leaders may bring passionate reactions. I could bring up some examples, but I won't at the moment, lest I get too political. But that does happen. The king reacted in rage to the non-compliant subjects. His reaction was noted in rather strong language. He was very passionate in his anger. He evidently took their disobedience as a personal affront as well as an act of outright insubordination. And he commanded an immediate meeting with them. And this was obviously a serious matter for him, and he was not about to tolerate any defiance or neglect of what he had communicated. And he didn't care who they were or what they believed. The king reiterated his expectations and the consequences. He was reasonable enough at least to ask them if in fact they had not conformed to his demands. And he graciously gave them another opportunity to respond appropriately. He could have killed them on the spot. That could easily have been the case. He sought to be sure that they understood the demand that he, and that he understood their response. Let's be sure we're communicating here. Do I understand this right? Do you understand what I'm saying, what I'm demanding? And in the process, the king indicates something of his worldview and his position. He indicated his understanding that no God was above him. That's how he perceived things. He indicated that his authority was supreme in his mind. Now, you've heard of someone who is a legend in their own mind. That's what he was. There was no other option but to conform to his demands. You could not get a religious exemption. That was not an option. Sounds familiar. So the king made clear his intentions, his expectations, and these Jewish captives are about to do the same. Verses 16 and 17, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If that is the case, that is what you're demanding of us, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us from your hand, O king. But if not, let it be known to you, O king, that we do not serve your gods, nor will we worship the gold image which you have set up." So they indicated, we do not now serve your gods, and we will not worship the image that you have set up. You are not going to demand of us. We are not going to conform to your demand that we capitulate our personal, strongly held belief in the true and living God. A biblical response includes clear commitment and... oh, that last part, that's a little disturbing. Serious risk. Can't we just be committed without having to take a risk in the process? Well, we know that that's very much part of the equation. We must be clear about where our allegiance lies. Now, in our world today, it seems there are many people who are not as clear as to where their commitment lies as they could be, where their allegiance is, even though they may call themselves Christians. Is that really where their allegiance is? And we need to perhaps at times evaluate ourselves. Do we really have the allegiance that we say we do? Are we really trusting God? Well, for these guys, there was no question about where they stood. They said, "We do not serve your gods, and we will not worship your image." We are going to have to take a stand on many such issues in our day, already, now, and in the future. It's going to intensify. The battle lines have been drawn. They're being drawn before our eyes. You think of some of the issues that have been rather prominent, the matter of abortion, euthanasia, the sexual revolution, and all that's involved with that. And really, abortion and the sexual revolution are one and the same. That is the sort of the doorway that brings about the equality that they're seeking. And it's being forced upon our society with legal action. And what are the consequences of going against these laws that are intensifying going to be? Fines, jail, or beyond? Economic hardship? That is all in the process of becoming reality, I'm afraid. So we must be aware of the risk of facing consequences. Though we trust God, we cannot assume that we know His will in every circumstance. He is certainly able to deliver, but He may have us serve Him by our personal sacrifice or even martyrdom. He may choose to deliver us, or He may not. Are we still firm in our commitment to Him, even then? Can we really know how we will respond in such circumstances? It's fairly easy when the pressure is not on us, when we are not facing a specific immediate situation. It's easy to say, "Oh yeah, I'll stand up," and then when the pressure's on, can we? Will we? How will we deal with that? Will we be able to respond as they did? Are we fully resigned to submission to God as opposed to the government or other entities? So, a lesson on the limits of personal autonomy. Personal autonomy is kind of the rule of the day. That's where we live. That's what drives much of our society currently. Looking at verses 19 to 20, "Then Nebuchadnezzar was full of fury, and the expression on his face changed toward Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He spoke and commanded that they heat the furnace seven times more than it was usually heated. And he commanded certain mighty men of valor who were in his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and cast them into the burning fiery furnace." So rather vivid description of what's going on here. "Then these men were bound in their coats, their trousers, their turbans, and their other garments, and were cast into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. Therefore, because the king's command was urgent and the furnace exceedingly hot, the flame of the fire killed those men who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell down bound into the midst of the burning fiery furnace." Fortunately, the story doesn't end there. It could. It's like, that's it. They're burned up. Let's move on. Pick another topic. There are logical consequences to threats and commitments. Well, the king passionately followed through with his threat of punishment for lack of conformity. He was committed to his purpose. His loyalty had been resisted, and he was angered at the lack of conformity and the failure to show allegiance, and so he was prepared to make an example out of them, and that's exactly what he's doing. And he demanded that the fire be turned up even hotter, and it's references seven times more. That's generally a proverbial expression, hyperbole, that means as much as possible or much more to a greater extent. And he had to keep up his image as the tough guy. Everybody's got to conform to me. I'll do whatever it takes. He was simply doing what a ruler does. Self-preservation. I got to look good. I've got to be the leader. And it was in his best interest to appear strong and in charge. And it seems there's a lot of that going around today as well. We don't have to look very far. We could give some initials and you'd know who I was talking about, but I won't. You can just imagine. The accused men followed through with their commitment to resist the pressure to worship a false god. They were immediately removed from the king's presence and placed into the fiery furnace. They were given no opportunity for preparations. They couldn't change their clothes and put on fire clothes. Would have been nice if they could have had some proper equipment. They couldn't make any appeals. They were thrown in the fire as they were, clothes and all. And they likely had no further opportunity to change their mind. By that point, they couldn't say, wait, we changed our mind. Never mind. Whatever you say, King. Well, they were committed no matter what. They had already given their position. They had already stated where they were coming from, what they believed, what they were holding to, and they followed through. Do you wonder how they came to their conclusions? When did they decide that they would go to the fiery furnace rather than obey the king's demand to worship a false deity? When did they decide that? And what would you have done if you had been under that pressure? I don't really want to think about it. You know, that would be hard. How do you deal with that? I'd like to think I could do it, but I don't know. Could I? Am I that committed? You need to decide now. What will you do under those circumstances? Daniel 3, verse 24 and 25. Then King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished, and he rose in haste and spoke, saying to his counselors, "Did we not cast three men into the midst of the fire? Three men bound into the fire?" They answered and said to the king, "True, O king." "Look," he answered, "I see four men loose, walking in the midst of the fire, and they are not hurt. And the form of the fourth is like the Son of God." Literally, it's a son of God's. More general terminology, but the reality is he was right. Most likely. In verse 26, then Nebuchadnezzar went near the mouth of the burning fiery furnace and spoke, saying, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out and come here." Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came from the midst of the fire. Well, that's an amazing statement of events there that just took place. It's easy to just say it in a few sentences, but to think about what actually happened. There are practical consequences to trusting the Lord or not trusting the Lord. The king here observed supernatural intervention personally. He saw it right up front of him, and he was bound to have to respond in some way. He never, I don't think anyway, that he would have expected that this would have happened or imagined it. I'm trying to think, would he have had any background, any other circumstance? Was it because they were so strongly committed that he thought maybe they could? Maybe because they said that God would deliver them. Could he have thought maybe that's a possibility? Because people don't normally survive burning fiery furnaces. And in this case, he was partly responsible for them being in there because he's the one that made it a necessity. He had given the ultimatum. He had caused this situation to come to pass. Of course, God allowed it to happen. He rightly recognized a form that was in this furnace that had not been thrown in there, that was with the other individuals. And there was something about this fourth individual that caught his attention as something other than just another person, whether it was just a regular angel or whether it was the angel of the Lord. It doesn't say. My speculation is it may have been the angel of the Lord. But you'll notice that he did not deliver them from the fire. He delivered them in the fire or through the fire. And sometimes we need to keep that in mind when we are facing difficulties. What is the Lord going to do? Is he going to deliver us from the difficult situation, or is he going to deliver us through it? He's going to give us the wherewithal to make it through. And that, I think, is a helpful thing to think about, because God often does not keep us out of trouble, but he helps us persevere through it. You think about the toxic fumes, the heat that would have been going on in that furnace situation. That is a spectacular, miraculous event. But I'm also reminded of Romans 8:37. Yet in all these things we are more than conquerors through him who loved us. He's always with us. That is an encouragement. He can bring us through those difficulties. The men experienced supernatural intervention directly. It was very real to them because they didn't know for sure whether they were going to be preserved. Did they? They were confident in the Lord. They thought that he certainly could, and they were hoping he would. But they were definitely trusting and hoping and likely praying through it all. And they certainly would have been astonished to realize, hey, the ropes burned off, but my clothes didn't burn. How does that happen? That's amazing. And so the angel was there to probably help sustain and encourage them. We're not sure of the mechanism that took place there. Was there an invisible force field? Was there, you know, how does that work? Probably seen too many science fiction films to, you know, what's the mechanism? I don't know. I don't know how that worked. But it was amazing. Spectacular situation. But here the king also rightly recognized these were servants of the Most High God. They had told him that they serve their God. And he recognized the Most High God is indicating this is a God above all else. And the king had been of the impression that he was above all and there was none above him, though he should have known from the previous experience that he had had with the dream. But that was simply an acknowledgement that God can let you know something that's going to happen in the future. This is a greater power than the king himself. So I think this was a bigger deal. So when Most High God is used, it's indicating the highest ultimate authority. And this title is used 13 times in Daniel. And it indicates that Yahweh has greater power and authority than any other. It's used by Daniel and by Nebuchadnezzar. And it's usually to delineate God among other gods. He is above and beyond. That's the thing that's communicated there. Did my button not? There we go. And the satraps, verse 27, and the satraps, administrators, governors, and the king's counselors gathered together, and they saw these men on whose bodies the fire had no power. So the other people are kind of looking around. Look at that. These guys got thrown in the fire furnace, and they're not all burned up. Imagine that. The hair of their head was not singed, nor were their garments affected, and the smell of smoke was not on them. That is amazing. You can walk into a room where someone has had smoking embers in some form or another, and you can come away smelling like smoke just with that little bit. So it is really quite amazing. Verse 28, Nebuchadnezzar spoke, saying, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who sent his angel and delivered his servants who trusted in him. And they have frustrated the king's word." Now that's quite an admission. "And yielded their bodies." They submitted themselves to this punishment. "That they should not serve nor worship any god except their own god." Are we prepared to do that? "Therefore I make a decree that any people, nation, or language which speaks anything amiss against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be cut in pieces, and their houses shall be made an ash heap, because there is no other God who can deliver like this." You notice it doesn't say, "and I worship him." He might eventually, but it doesn't say that. "Then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon." Interesting. There are surprising results from divine intervention. Many people may observe the effects of intervention, but are those effects correctly interpreted? They can see the effects of things that God has done or is doing, and they may or may not interpret it correctly. And so we have to be careful that even though we may say, "Well, that's obviously God at work," someone else may say, "Well, I don't see that," because they're not coming from the same perspective. These men were still alive after the ordeal, and that was, of course, a miracle in itself. And they showed none of the effects from the fire. The ropes were burned off. Their clothes didn't smell. This was more than a second-class miracle. Now, do you remember the classifications of miracles? First-class miracle is what? First class. This is something that only God could do. It is completely outside of the realm of human functionality. Second-class miracle is circumstances and events and details come together in such a way that this could only be a miraculous event, but it's using normal kinds of things. This was more than a second-class miracle. This was a first-class miracle. I don't know if you normally rate your miracles, but it's a good practice. There are several evidences of divine intervention in this. You know, the soldiers were killed when they tried to throw them in. There was a fourth person seen inside. There was no harm of any sort on them, not even any smell. The ropes were gone. I mean, just the whole thing. Important responses may result from divine intervention. Some men were blessed by the intervention. The three individuals in particular, they survived. But the king also recognized his limitations under God's power. His word was subverted, and he acknowledged Yahweh's sovereignty over his own god, Nebo. And he issued a decree ordering everyone to respect Yahweh and to say nothing against him. And that probably also made it possible for the Jews who were captives to live in greater comfort and ease with greater freedom to serve the Lord in that environment. So all of this probably was instrumental for a cause that the Lord was bringing about for his own purposes. Now, there may be formal acknowledgement of God's actions. This was the case here because the king acknowledged the need to worship the true God. The The men would no longer be asked to worship other gods, which they had just been asked. The king issued a decree to stop the slander of the true God. The king said that no other god would deliver or could deliver like the true God. He didn't say the true God, but he at least recognized the Most High God above all else, which is, in a sense, an acknowledgement of that. And the king gave the men promotions in his kingdom. All of these were huge concessions to the true God. And it's a reminder of what God can do when things look hopeless. And everything looked hopeless at that time. And we're facing many situations and circumstances today that look hopeless. That look like, I don't see how we're going to pull through this. I don't see how we're going to be able to make it if these things come to pass as are being put in place or attempted to be put in place today. But what we need to remember is that God is still the ultimate superpower. He is the ultimate, the true superhero. And we can trust in him, and he can and he may intervene in ways that we may not even imagine. And we need to be prepared to trust in him and to recognize that he is still the ultimate authority. We can trust him in any and all circumstances, and that he will do what is best, and he has a bigger picture in mind of what is going on, so that he may allow something to happen that looks like it's horrible, but he's accomplishing something else that we may not immediately see, and we need to recognize that as well. So when the pressures and the powers around us come to us to urge us to capitulate to the various faulty and sinful laws and mandates, etc., we need to discern what is right and wrong, when is it right to resist, and then be fully committed to follow through with what is right, no matter what. We must all be prepared to promote what is good, to identify and resist what is evil, to refrain from it, to continue to worship Yahweh in spirit and in truth, to trust the Word of God, to proclaim it clearly, and to rely on God's provision for life and liberty in Christ. Can we and do we trust him in the circumstances of life? Now, we have trusted him for our salvation. That's a pretty big deal. Can we trust him in the circumstances of life? Yes, we can. We should. We must.